You may be bulletproof, but you're not love-proof. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast telling you the bird season is over, Butthorn. Now, when you think of the action stars of the 80s and 90s, you probably start thinking of Messrs. Schwarzenegger, Stallone, Seagal, or Van Damme. After that, maybe your mind moves to second-tier stars like Gary Daniels, Jeff Speakman, or Michael Dudikoff, or perhaps to video store stalwarts like Don the Dragon Wilson, Reb Brown, or Robert Ginty. But one name that comes a long way down on that list, if it's mentioned on that list at all, is the star of the film we're reviewing here, Gary Busey, which, when you think about it, is really, really odd, because he was in some of the biggest action movies of the time. Lethal Weapon, Point Break, Predator 2, Under Siege. Now, he might not be in the star of those films, but he certainly was in things like Eye of the Tiger and the film we're reviewing here, 1987's Bulletproof. To help me review the film, I'm joined by a man who likes to sit on the beach playing plaintive saxophone licks. It's Matt Poirier from the DTV Connoisseur. Welcome back to the show, Matt.
Thank you, Will. And yes, I wish I was the kind of smooth jazz artist that our man Mr. Busey was in this film.
It's something that we all really should aspire to. So yeah, maybe we'll get there. Maybe we'll get there one day. Now, you've been on this show before, and this is now your fifth appearance here. And every time you're on, I like to make a comparison to the frequency with which actors turn up on your own blog, because you very diligently catalogue how frequently actors have appeared on your mighty site, the DTV Connoisseur. So I had a look at the actors who've been tagged 5 times on your blog, and I came up with the names Adrian Paul, Bo Svensson, Brian Bosworth, and John Saxon. So who out of that lot are you most flattered to be compared to, Matt?
Wow. So I mean, obviously, you know, John Saxon, of course, comes to mind just because, he's just such I don't know if legend's the right term, but, you know, he's a legend. But then I have to confess that in the 90s, I was a huge fan of syndicated TV here in the U.S., and Adrian Paul as the Highlander, I mean, that was like, I'd get home from school and I'd watch the Highlander. I mean, I think I have all the episodes on DVD somewhere. Probably when I moved down here to Philadelphia, I put a bunch of stuff in my parents' basement with the idea that I was going to do something with it at some time. So it's probably collecting dust there. But, you know, yes, Adrian Paul as the Highlander, the fact that I should say, on the one hand, I love that we have the same number of tags. On the other side, it feels a little appalling that I only have 5 Adrian Paul films on my site, so maybe I need to remedy that.
Well, of all the names that I threw out there, I wasn't expecting you to embrace his the most enthusiastically. So this is the joy of doing these types of shows, is what you learn about your guests in an accidental way.
Yes. Yeah, I was a huge fan of Highlander. I loved it, especially when he moved to Paris. Those episodes, the idea of Highlander is so silly, I guess. It's just like these immortal people going around cutting each other's heads, and they're all like really old, and you know, they would do those period pieces. But for some reason, it with him on the series, it worked for me, and it made and I can't explain it. I don't, you know, there's no explanation, but it did.
Now, in my intro, I talked about Gary Busey and about how, I don't know, for me, I guess he's a bit of a sort of unheralded name when it comes to like talking or thinking about action films in the 80s and 90s. Now, you know, what I wanted to do, though, is test that really with you. I mean, do you think that he is a bit of a neglected name when we think about this genre? And what do you, more generally, what do you think he brings to the screen in the films that he's in?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons why he's more neglected is I think he's become almost sort of a comic figure more recently. And I think people forget that when you go back to something like obviously like a Bulletproof, but if you go back to his you know, when you go back to something like Point Break, you know what I mean? He's not really being comedic there, right? He's playing a kind of a legitimate, I mean, there is something, about his character that's a little bit, you know, kind of funny. But Under Siege, those kinds of things, I guess. You're right, like there's the part that he's not the star, and so of course we always think of the stars more than we think of the supporting characters, but yeah, I you know, this movie really for me shows like just how good he could be, you know, when he gets the star. This one in Eye of the Tiger. So I think you're right. I think he's one that people more think of it as like, you know, My friends and I, we would joke, we had what we called the abusive scale when we watched the Gary Busey movie. We talked about how abusive the film was, and I brought that over to my site. You know, like, the movie was whatever on the abusive scale, like highly abusive, you know, fairly abusive. You know, like how much Gary, because that's the thing too, right, is that as Gary Busey goes on, he's in these films less and less. You know, sometimes it's just him on the cover, and you see him for 5 minutes. I think you're right. I think he's neglected partly because we see him kind of more as like a joke now. And I think you're right that we should go back and kind of visit his filmography in a different way. I mean, he also was nominated for an Oscar for the Buddy Holly film in 79. So he's got more range, and he's done more stuff than just sort of this goofy yelling guy that we kind of know of him as now.
Yeah, he definitely seemed to get into, I guess you'd call it sort of that Al Pacino type vein, where there was a certain thing that he could do, that sort of goofy, shouty guy. And he just generally, yeah, people just, yeah, give me shouty, goofy guy. We're not really interested in seeing the other strings that you might have to your bow. That we know you can do that one good thing, and we just want you to keep on doing it.
Yeah, and I think you're right that when you go back into these, when you look at the CV, I mean, it is like you said, when you go to somebody's IMDb page, I think it's very telling what the top four movies are that IMDb thinks you should know for them. And in his case, you know, it is. It's the Buddy Holly story that he was nominated for an Oscar for, and then three big, I would say, blockbusters. I mean, Point Break, obviously, is a big one. Lethal Weapon, I mean, that kicks off a franchise. And then Under Siege, right, where you know, he and Tommy Lee Jones play two baddies that really steal the show in that, right? I mean, I don't know that Seagal's performance, even though it got a sequel, I don't know that his performance was what it's over, right? We enjoyed seeing the baddies in that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we recently reviewed Under Siege on the Exploding Helicopter podcast, and there we were talking about just how, frankly, little screen time Steven Seagal is in the film. I forget, like, how many minutes he's actually in the film, but it's quite low when you consider he's the star of this film. And yeah, it's really the Tommy Lee Jones show and Gary Busey, as both of them try to outdo each other with the sort of eccentricities of the villains that they're playing. So yeah, they definitely, it's a shame. I mean, we'd obviously, the circumstances of, I guess what we needed from Under Siege 2 was a prequel, the kind of the Tommy Lee Jones, Gary Busey prequel, where how they kind of get together, how they originally meet, and kind of some sort of plan or crime that they commit there. Because I want to see more of their adventures.
Yeah, like kind of like with the Fast and Furious movies, where like Vin Diesel make like this 20-minute, like, you know, short film that will like kind of bridge the sequels sometimes. Like, yeah, a nice 20-minute short with the two of them doing something. I would have really loved too. What was it with the Lethal Weapon, where it was like a movie? Was it Gone Fishing or something like that? Where like Joe Pesci and Danny Glover's characters went on a fishing trip or something? Like, that would have been great too, just to have the two of them go on a fish, like a movie where they go on a fishing trip and get into some kind of hijinks.
Sounds good. I mean, all these ideas just, you know, lost like tears in the rain, aren't they?
Yes, but exactly.
Okay, I think it's time we got stuck into Bulletproof. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a trailer for this film, so instead, let's listen to some grizzled military types outline the plot for us.
Gentlemen, you can turn on the 6 o'clock news and see more about our status as a world power than I could tell you. The point is, the threat that we're dealing with is close. Too close to home.
We recently confirmed the presence of enemy forces just 300 miles south of our border.
Locals?
Joint effort. Cubans, Nicaraguans, Arabs, revolutionaries, Sergeant. Terrorists being trained for use not only within Mexico, but eventually up here in Gringoland.
Well, my gut feeling, I just fly in and frag the hell out of them, sir.
It's not quite that simple, Sergeant.
No, we've got to be much more discreet.
You mean a surgical strike?
Yeah, of sorts.
There's a new toy of ours, the MBT-90 Thunderblast.
Oh, yeah, I've heard rumors. Which you probably started, sir.
Then you know we can't let it fall in the hands of the enemy.
Unless, of course, we want it to.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Gary Busey plays McBain, a former CIA agent turned renegade loose cannon cop. After an experimental super tank, brilliantly nicknamed the Thunderblast, is stolen, Busey is called back in to work for the agency. They want him to travel to Mexico and recover the stolen superweapon from the ragtag collection of Arab terrorists and Latin American commies who are behind the heist. Alongside Busey, we have the late, great Henry Silver and a notable assortment of screen toughs. So there's Danny Trejo, biker movie legend William Smith, and Sam Peckinpah favourite LQ Jones, and the perma-grizzled R.G. Armstrong. The film was directed by Steve Carver, who made the Corman exploitation flick Big Bad Mama, and the Chuck Norris actioners An Eye for an Eye and Lone Wolf McQuade. There are three writers credited for the script, including B-movie legend Fred Olen Ray, who was originally supposed to direct this film. The other notable point to mention about the film is its association to The Simpsons, which has a fictional action movie with the same name of McBain. Now, this character is clearly drawing inspiration from actors like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Bruce Willis, but you can't help seeing links between that fictional character and this movie. Bulletproof has a 4.9 user rating on IMDb and a user rating of exactly 3 out of 5 on Letterboxd. So, with all of that out of the way, Matt, what did you make of Bulletproof?
Boy, yeah. So I, you know, I went back to my original review that I did, you know, I don't know how long ago, you know, just to kind of see what my thoughts were then. And they were kind of similar watching it this time around. Here's maybe what I think. And I'm going to kind of call back to when you were on my podcast a little while back and we did two non-Bonds. The idea of this film is fantastic, right? The idea of, like, let's get a tank, like a kind of a secret, you know, weapon that the U.S. government has, have it be captured by a group of, like, terrorists, and then send your best soldier in to get that tank and destroy the terrorists, right? Destroy their cell with the tank. The idea is fantastic, but thinking about, you know, James Bond films, essentially you have enough material for the very beginning of a James Bond film where he is finishing a mission, right, before we get into the actual two and a half hour real, you know, what the movie's about. That's about what we had here. And to pad the film, we get a lot of prisoner padding, right? We get a lot of, you know, we don't get as much of the fun McBain stuff. So there was that piece. The other piece is, I guess, kind of maybe going back to the UK as well. The film had a bit of it felt like there were a lot of scenes that could have been set to the soundtrack of, you know, Yakety Sax, right? The Benny Hill theme. Like that scene where he's tied to, like, this large cable wheel. And Darlene Fugel blows it up or blows up a grenade, right? And he starts rolling down the street. I'm like, I just started hearing like that, you know? And there were other scenes like that that could have felt that way too, which may get to the whole Gary Busey thing, like why we don't take him as seriously. So the movie had a bit of that feel to it. So there's a couple things there. The padding, I think, didn't work. There wasn't enough material for this to work as well as it should have. By the same token, Busey was fun, and I think that always helps.
I love the term prisoner padding. I mean, we've all seen movies which are like, we've got to get this to the 85-minute runtime, so we're just going to kind of have some extended prison scenes with people sitting around chewing the fat or something just to get the runtime up. But you bring up a really interesting point about the tone of this film, which was definitely something that I wanted to talk about, which was, you know, it's played with a deadly straight face. But there are many parts of this film, and you've already mentioned some of them, where it sails very, very close to being like a hotshot-style action parody. And, I mean, I don't know what your view was. I felt like the film, that these were deliberate choices, that the film was deliberately almost parodying the kind of the action genre. But I mean, I don't know. As I say, Fred Olen Ray was involved in writing the script. He was originally slated to direct. I wonder if something got lost maybe in the change of directors that it sort of perhaps was going to be more tongue-in-cheek parody, but then Steve Carver kind of comes in and straightens it out. I don't know. I was interested if for some further thoughts from you on sort of, where this film was aiming for.
Yeah, you make a really fantastic point there, actually, because I hadn't really considered this fact, because there's one scene that tonally really, really disrupts the movie completely, and that's when Darlene Flugel's character is raped off-screen by Henry Silva's character. And it's such a dark thing to happen in the film. And one of the things maybe that you make a good point is if Fred Olen Ray was doing this in a more tongue-in-cheek fashion, kind of going back to the Betty Hill part, he might have not necessarily gone for like a full-on rape thing, but he might have used it in a way to sort of maybe, you know, get a, maybe Darlene Flugel's character would have been maybe a more busty, you know, like a, you know, I don't know, like a Julie K. Smith or somebody like that, like a, you know, somebody like that. And the scene would have been there just to get her topless, you know, maybe a shirt gets ripped off just to be able to show boobs for this scene, right? And it would have been like, it might have tonally worked better with the whole thing. And instead, it was like this dark moment where you're just like, oh, you know, like it could have used, like, you know, I think they could have gotten their point across even if, like, he didn't go, if Henry Silva didn't go all the way, but he did, like, kind of rip the clothes off in a Betty Hill style fashion, right? You know, like, where, you know, women just sort of suddenly have no clothes on when they're running around at the end of the, you know, the series. And that would explain, because, you know, Fred Olen Ray and directors like him at that time, they would have put a scene like that in a movie like that just to get some TNA into it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, when you start thinking about this film, you do think that there was an idea of parody or send-up sort of in the minds of the people sort of developing this film. Because, you know, if you think about the villains who are involved in this, I mean, they are like, you don't just have... I mean, if you watched 80s action films, you know, you had your sort of like Latin American revolutionaries, you had the Russians, you know, you had Arab terrorists. Here, you have all of them in one film. So you have this sort of United Nations of Evil where you have Cubans, Nicaraguans, Arabs and Russians all working together to sort of, you know, attack America with a very half-baked plan, but, you know, we won't go into that. And that just feels like, you know, that, you know, there's no logic to it other than the fact of, yeah, let's just put every single one of America's 80s, you know, enemies into one film. And, you know, you also have scenes which I alluded to it in your intro, where you have Gary Busey sort of having sat on a beach, having a flashback, you know, he's having a flashback to his sort of, you know, love affair with Diane, I forget her name, but she plays Deborah, was it Shepherd? She plays Shepherd in this film. And, you know, you've got that kind of cliched sax music that you get in all of those films. And Gary Busey is playing the sax in his own sort of love scene flashback. I mean, it just, that's got to be tongue in cheek, right?
Right, because it is, like, when you think of, like, a Hot Shots or something like that, that's exactly what would happen, right? Is that you would see, like, two characters, like, kind of running along the beach, and then you just think the sax was in the background, and then you'd see someone playing it, you know? And, yeah, I mean that whole thing, right, with Gary Busey kind of, like, lusting after his best friend's girl, who is, you know, Darlene Flugel, it had a whole, like Rick Springfield, Jesse's Girl feel to it, you know, and it's almost like, oh, there he is now, you know, he's just in his head thinking, oh, he's watching her with those eyes, you know, and now he's, yeah, I'm sure he's loving her with that body, I just know it. Only Gary Busey's the one who ends up having sex with her after, and it's like, oh, okay, so he's cheating on his best friend, you know, like, so it, but it did have that vibe to it, but that, you're right, like, the saxophone thing, that was just, I don't know if it was out of nowhere, but it's just like, yeah, like, hey, I'm just going to go take my saxophone on the beach and just belt out this smooth jazz tune, you know?
But it's played so straight, isn't it? Yes. Like, it doesn't, there's no winking to camera at all.
No.
It's just deadly straight.
Yeah, it's just like, here's our hero, right? He's a Renaissance man. He can, you know, play the saxophone on the beach.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's just throughout the film, there's just all these little bits, like, in the... There used to be a blog called Saturday Night Screening, and they used to call this segment of action films the unrelated opening action sequence, the the UOAS of the film. So we have, you know, during that we have Gary Busey doing this raid on some weapons dealers who sort of decide to arrive and make their getaway from this weapons deal in an ice cream truck, which just seems to basically. Just seems to be have been chosen for comic value, and then there's, you know, we have Danny Trejo You know, sort of rummaging around for grenades, sort of in the back of this truck, and you know, his colleague is going, "Oh, you know, the grenades are in the popsicles," and it's just, you know, this is clearly, as we were saying, this could be straight out of Hot Shots for sure.
Yeah, and that scene was so much fun that I kind of likened it to like being out with somebody who's like spending a lot of money initially, that you think that this person's rich and they can cover everything. And then you go to a restaurant with them and they run up a huge bill and you're stuck with it, you know? And that was kind of how this movie was. It was like, it seemed like it had tons of cash that it could just play with. And the next thing you knew, like it was completely out of money after that first scene. And then now we just got a whole bunch of, you know, prisoner padding. Because, you know, I kept thinking we were just going to get like every, you know, 15 to 20 minutes, something like that scene. And that wasn't what we got there. So it was another thing, too, is it was almost like false advertising, right? Mm. That it was like, you know, it was essentially the hook that pulled us in. And then we're just kind of like, okay, well, it can't just be them sitting in a Mexican church, you know, being held prisoner. That can't be. It's got to be more Busey. And so it was like kind of your perfect kind of 80s fun actioner that... when I was watching this, I was like, why did I not like this movie? This is a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying this. And then I was like, oh, I completely like excised out of my brain that whole, you know, middle of the movie where nothing happens.
Yeah. And I think you're absolutely spot on there. I mean, the first like 20 minutes are great. The last 25 minutes are great as well. It's pretty very heavy on action there, but there is that middle section of, I don't know, 30 to 40 minutes, which is, yeah, prisoner padding, and it definitely sort of shifts down into second for a while there before kind of like going up through the gears back towards the end.
Yeah, and I mean, even at the end, like there was, I don't know how to run this thing padding, which is another form of padding, right? Which we seem to get in a lot of these movies, right? Where it's like, you know, you get in the tank and the person can't figure it out until just when they need to be able to shoot something, right? It's like, oh, all hope is like, there. Oh, come on, you got to figure it out. You got to figure it out. And it's like, we know you're going to figure out how to run the tank. We know you're going to do it. But instead, you got to give us like 10 minutes of just like, oh, are we going to figure it out? Oh, you know, come on, do this quick. No, they're coming. You got to get, you know, and I, that whole thing, it's like, yeah, it's one of those things where it's just like you're just doing it just to give it, you know, just to create like this sense of, I don't know, like this suspense or something like that. And then, yes, it would have been hilarious if they never figured out how to use the tank and the tank got blown up and that was the end of the movie, right? But that wasn't what happened.
Yeah, I mean, talking of figuring things out, I mean, one thing I did start wondering about, particularly in the kind of rather, you know, kind of run-of-the-mill midsection that this film does unfortunately suffer from was the sort of the power dynamics between the villains here. So we've got Henry Silver is playing an Arab terrorist for, yes. For hey, it was the 80s, so such things right. were such things were fairly acceptable. We've got you know, we got these you know, Cubans, we've got these Nicaraguans, we've got William Smith leading a bunch of Russians as well. I was wondering how the power dynamics, I mean, it wasn't really sort of clear, like, who was in charge. I mean, you guess, it seemed like Henry Silver was in charge, but that's mostly down to the amount of screen time he had. I mean, yeah, I mean, the other thing that baffled me was, what exactly was their plan in this movie?
Yeah, none of it, right, because it was, I think there was this idea of, like, wanting to launch terrorist attacks in America from Mexico kind of thing. I don't know for sure. But yeah, and then of course, like, yeah, we think that Henry Silva is the leader, and then suddenly we get William Smith at the end, which is like, I guess what happens sometimes is you get this sort of bigger boss or, you know, this extra. The problem was that they never, you know, I guess they hinted at him to us well early on in a scene that we weren't expecting to think that, you know, it's like he's, because there's this flashback scene where his friend gets killed, where Gary Busey's friend, who's Darlene Flugel's husband, or Darlene Flugel's husband, when he dies, right, we see him in this botched drug deal with you know, an uncredited Kerry Tagawa, and I guess that was supposed to be the thing, like, oh, hey, by the way, this guy is a Russian general. You just didn't know it. He's just he looks like just some slick, you know, early 80s dude with a nice leather jacket on, right? Playing like a, you know, doing a guest spot on an episode of, like, you know, Magnum or you know, Matt Houston or something, you know, and instead, no, he's the general, he's the real baddie in this film. And I don't know. And the other thing too is that around the same time, he played a Russian general in the AIP flick. What was that one called?
I think he was one. Wasn't he one in Red Dawn as well?
Exactly, Red Dawn. So of all the things to be typecast as, I guess it makes sense with Dolph being typecast as a Russian, but interesting that William Smith was typecast. And it was just sort of like one of those things where, I think you're right, like the Fred Olin Ray aspect, I think he almost created like kind of this bouillabaisse kind of approach to it, where it's just like throw everything in the pot and make it work. And this sort of works in that vein. But you're right, it makes it really difficult because you're just like, who is leading this game here? Because like, at one scene, you're right, like when William Smith shows up, Henry Silver is like crying to him almost about how they lost the tank. And it's like, okay, so who's our baddie here? You're right, like, you know.
Well, we probably should talk about the Simpsons here, because anyone who's watched that show will be aware of the fictional action movie hero McBain, who's, you know, basically sort of played as if the sort of like a satirical version of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Now, I don't believe that there is anything definitive on the origins of the McBain character in the Simpsons, and certainly there's another film, 1991's McBain with Christopher Walken amongst many others, which again features a very outlandish plot. And you suspect that has also sort of filtered into the Simpsons creators' thinking. But Matt, what are your thoughts on, I guess, the DNA between those films and, you know, the kind of McBain character that we get in the Simpsons?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that there's some, I don't want to say like some...
Yeah, connective tissue?
Yeah, because I think one of the things, you know, when you think about like all of these kinds of, you know, coming up with these sort of things, I mean, it would not be beyond the pale, right? For especially, you know, thinking of the Simpsons starting in the late 80s, it would make sense that you know, that there would be some sort of like, I don't know, some sort of partial inspiration. I mean, as myself, you know, I'm you know, sort of self-published novelist, but inspiration comes from anywhere. You know, you never know where you're going to see something that's going to be like, oh, I should put that in something. And so I would not be surprised if there are certain elements, or just even just the name. Someone's just like, oh, that's a great name for a, you know, for that, you know, and then they sort of, you know, build it from there.
Well, I mean, it is a great name, and you can tell it's a great name because nobody in this film can seem to go more than 2 minutes without going, McBain! Right. God damn it, McBain! Right. I mean, you wouldn't want to do a drinking game where you had to take a shot every time somebody says, you know, God damn it, McBain.
Well, actually, to be honest, I think the filmmakers would appreciate that because you would completely forget about the middle section where nothing's happening. If you're, you know, by that point, right, you would have heard so many McBains, especially in the beginning of the film with all the stuff that happens there. I mean, Thalmas Razulala, I can't pronounce his name, but his partner says his name so many times at the beginning because he's just annoyed by him, like going in and not waiting for backup, right? You know, McBain is one of those cops that doesn't wait for backup, right? He just goes in. And, you know, that you would have been so drunk, you'd been so inebriated by that point that you would have missed the whole middle of the film. So actually, I think they would have preferred that you played the McBain drinking game.
And you'd just be sort of like, you know, the kind of, you sort of just be sort of, some of the alcohol would just be sort of coming out of your system towards the back end 20 minutes of the film. So you'd be, oh, yeah. And you'd just like, yeah, oh, this film's great.
Right at that point when you're like, you know, like you're elbow deep in the bag of chips, right? You're just like, you're just like stuffing, you know, you're like, you'd be like, oh, this, yeah, you're right. Like it would be just in time for when they figured out how to use the tank. And yeah, you'd be, yeah. It's kind of like my dad when it came to baseball, American baseball here in the, or I shouldn't say American baseball, there's no other, but baseball in the U.S., he always joked that you'd fall asleep around the third inning, you know, take a nap, and then wake up for the end of the game, and it was perfect. See, that's the same thing about a lot of sports in America, like basketball, you know, fall asleep in the first quarter, wake up towards the end, and you're in perfect shape. This is kind of has that feel to it, right, that you could just wake up at the end and catch the exciting end of the movie.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, I mean... I think we're sort of winding up this section. What's your sort of overall, I guess, rating is, what's your overall verdict, I guess, on Bulletproof? Because there's definitely some stuff here that we liked, but, you know, by the same token, we've also identified some parts of this film that don't work as well. So, yeah, how would you sort of sum up Bulletproof? And, yeah, where do you sit? Where do you think it sort of sits within the Gary Busey canon?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a Gary Busey film, I think this is really, especially for people that aren't used to his 80s stuff, I think this is definitely worth checking out. I always kind of, when I rate my films, I always talk about sort of like, you know, whether you should buy, is it worth buying, worth renting, or, you know, worth just streaming for free, or just, you know, avoid it altogether. You know, as of us recording this, this is available on YouTube to watch. I think that's probably the best option in that sense that, like, all you're losing is your time with that padding in the middle, and you get some kind of more inspired, fun scenes out of it. I don't think this would be worth, like, you know, this is not the kind of thing that, like, a Vinegar Syndrome puts out a Blu-ray on that I'd say, like, oh, yeah, you got to, you know, spend whatever limited money you have on the you know, a Blu-ray version of that. I don't think this even needs a Blu-ray version. I think YouTube is probably the best place for it.
Yeah, I think I'm in a similar boat to yourself. I think this film is a lot of fun. And, you know, if you're interested in 80s Busey, or you've just got some, you know, you've got a love of 80s action films, then I think you definitely need to check out this film. It's got moments in it that will stick in your mind for a long, long time. And yeah, a bit of padding that you got to get through, but, you know, there's enough reward around that, I think, to make this a very worthwhile view. And I certainly didn't regret at all, you know, coming back and giving this film another watch for this particular show. So yeah, I think we can both heartily recommend this film to anyone listening here if you've not checked it out. But now's probably a good moment to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about the exploding helicopter action.
It is the right of the people to promote the general welfare.
This is our annual fundraising drive, and we would like you to contribute $10 million.
To provide for the common defense. It is the right of the people to rise up, to bear arms, to wage war. What does it take to set a country free? Christopher Walken, Maria Conchita Alonso, McBain, rated R.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. This occurs towards the end of the film, after our heroes have commandeered the Thunderblast tank. As they seek to make their getaway, they're required to engage the enemy's forces. These include what's meant to be a Mil Mi-24 Hind, but what's really a modified Sikorsky S-62, made up to look like one. As the gun turret on the tank has been damaged, our heroes have to drive the tank up a kind of ramp they've created by crushing a car, and point the gun barrel skyward, and then blast the helicopter to pieces. So, Matt, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
Yeah, I think the build-up to it was nice. I mean, the build-up, I think, it didn't pay off for the build-up for me. I think that maybe that's what I should say. You know, we first get the helicopter. We know that helicopter is probably going to get blown up at some point once we first see it. The helicopter itself puts in a very good effort in you know, shooting at the tank. And, you know, so it does a valiant job. I mean, a lot of times helicopters just show up and they get blown up. And so I appreciated that this one put up a good fight. But then we get like kind of an explosion in air, and then it drops sort of unceremoniously down to the ground in flames. And I always kind of prefer a full-on mid-air explosion with just shrapnel, you know, like where that's it, you know, that it's been blown to smithereens. So that was one thing I would have liked to have seen, you know, just seeing that the flaming hull hit the ground, or the flaming body hit the ground, and then that was it. That was a little bit sort of a little bit of a letdown for me. But otherwise, yeah, I think it worked.
Yeah, I would agree. I think overall, I was a little bit underwhelmed by this. I mean, I think, as you say, I think the build up, the kind of, you know, you've got this big, powerful helicopter going up against this super tank. You know, they kind of build that idea up of, you know, okay, these are, you know, two well equipped, you know, weapons of war. How's this gonna play out? But when the helicopter does ultimately explode, it's quite brief, and I guess there's nothing wrong with leaving people wanting more. In some ways, less is good if more is going to be worse. So, you know, perhaps this was about as good as they could make it with the, I don't know, the special effects they had available to them and things. But yeah, I would have been happier if we'd had, yeah, a sort of bigger explosion that had been stayed on screen for a bit longer. But if they'd given us more and it wasn't very good, then I think I would be grumbling about it. So yeah, I was left wanting more, but I think what we get here is all sort of largely positive. One thing though that we haven't mentioned that I thought was great was, I do love if the action movie hero of the film gets to dispatch a helicopter with a bit of a quip, and we get a Russian flavored kiss off line for this helicopter with Gary Busey going, "Eat this, Igor," before they fire the gun turret at the helicopter, which I enjoyed immensely.
Yes. Well, yeah, that would have been fantastic. A good das vidanya, right? There's I always love a good American saying das vidanya to a Russian that he's blowing up. I think that never gets old, right? Especially in an 80s film. The other thing is that this film is shot, I believe, in the same area that they filmed MASH, you know, the TV show. Ooh. And I mean, I don't know about you, but between the action films that I've watched, you know, for so long, and then of course, you know, following your site and Twitter and your podcast, whenever I watch MASH, I'm just like, what, you know, what these helicopters seem to just do okay. You know, helicopter. I guess there's one helicopter that gets shot down when McLean Stevenson's character when he dies. Which I think what I read was he didn't think he was going to be dying, right? He just wanted to leave the show, and they ended up killing his character off, and he found that out after the fact. But I think it's the only time a helicopter gets shot down in MASH. I'm trying to remember. But anyway, but yeah, just that interesting, you know, when I think of TV shows and helicopters, you know, Airwolf and MASH probably are the two that come to mind, and this is filmed in the same area that MASH was shot.
Now, Matt, I wanted to test your knowledge, or make you appreciate. I wanted to do both things, actually. That you've seen something, you know, quite rare here, because I think there are only 8 films that we've found where a helicopter has been blown up by a tank. So, you know, given the fact that there are sort of nearly 750 films with exploding helicopters, and there's only 8 of them feature a helicopter being blown up by a tank, you have seen something very rare here. So I wanted to test your knowledge. Can you think of one other film, or perhaps you can name all 8, Matt? I don't know how good you are going to be here. Can you name one other film that features a helicopter being blown up by a tank?
Boy, I can't think of. I'm trying to think of movies that have tanks. To be honest, like I feel like a Rambo or something, or like a ooh, you know, yeah,
you're fishing in the right waters, Matt.
Yeah, because I know, of course, the Rambo that I think of is Rambo using explosive tipped arrows and blowing up helicopters that way. But yeah, that's one area that I'm thinking. But yeah, I'm drawing a blank here on this, unfortunately.
Well, you got very, very close, because Rambo 3 does feature.
Right.
The ending of that film features, for reasons that scarcely make sense by this point in the film. Sylvester Stallone is in a tank, and you have the crazed General Zaysen in a big Mill Hind helicopter, and they just basically ram these two vehicles together, and obviously Stallone survives because he's got two more Rambo sequels to make still, right. So he comes out of that encounter alive. So that's one. The others are the Triple X2, the kind of with Ice Cube taking over from Vin Diesel in that film. You've got the Jan Michael Vincent early 90s Vietnam action flick Beyond the Call of Duty. Wolf Warrior 2, which I think that's got Scott Adkins in.
I haven't seen that one yet. I've seen the first one.
Yeah, I can't remember if it's the first or the second one that has Scott Adkins.
The first one, I think, has him. Okay. I don't think the second one does. Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. Getting them muddled up. But the second one does. It might not have Scott Adkins, but it does have an exploding helicopter destroyed by a tank in there. I'm going to butcher this name. An Indian film called Bargee 3, that has one. And then there's two, which I was looking forward to telling you about these two, Matt. So there's two more, and they are very unusual. I mean, it's a very unusual type of helicopter destruction, and the people involved in these two are just people you would not expect to be involved in it. So in Cradle to the Grave, which I think Jet Li, Mark Dacascos, the ending of that film features Tom Arnold, who is driving a tank. He then blows up a helicopter that is in flight using the tank that he happens to be in at that particular moment. And then the 1984 sort of comedy action film Best Defense, we get to see Eddie Murphy inside a tank blow up another helicopter there. So, Tom Arnold and Eddie Murphy have blown up helicopters using tanks. Arnold Schwarzenegger has not.
So
make sense of that.
I'll be frank. The Tom Arnold one doesn't surprise me as much, just because you could see in his case, right, the kind of characters that he plays in a movie, it actually kind of makes sense that character would be like just find himself in a tank and be blowing up a helicopter. Like that one makes more sense to me than I mean, Eddie Murphy, that one just is, of his entire career, I never would have guessed, you know, I never would have thought of that, you know, I mean, the only thing would have been better is if he was wearing the outfit from Raw while he was doing it.
Well, I mean, Eddie Murphy's appearance in that film is just totally bizarre. It feels like he was like a last minute, it's basically a Dudley Moore film, but it feels like Eddie Murphy was just sort of parachuted in at the last minute, and they just found some sort of way of writing him into that film, because he feels like he's in a completely different movie in that film. And I don't know, he's just like, oh yeah, he's suddenly really hot. He's got like 2 days spare. You know, quick, do some rewrites. We're putting him in the film. That scene is bizarre. Eddie Murphy just being in the film is bizarre. But Eddie Murphy and Tom Arnold, you know, never would have expected them to be involved in such a rare method of helicopter destruction. But there you go. So it's a weird and unique world that we move in when we are talking about films with chopper fireballs.
Yeah, it's interesting being on your show, because I think this is at least the second time that I've been a party to a unique helicopter explosion. Because in Royce, right, it was a helicopter that generally isn't seen in, or blown up in movies. And then I guess with Soldier Boys, we don't know if Aronofsky directed the chopper fireball scene. But I mean, the fact that we had an Oscar nominated director, you know, in, you know, directing that scene, you know, I don't know how many, you know, Oscar nominated or Oscar winning directors have done exploding helicopter scenes, but so it's interesting that it seems like whenever I'm on the show, right, we have some sort of a unique, and then of course, yeah, Last of the Finest, right, we had the only helicopter that's blown up using sewage, I guess, so.
you're being very polite there, Matt, about what the sludgy substance that is, that is connected to the destruction of the helicopter in that that film. I appreciate you keeping this a clean podcast. But well, you know, I do try to shine a light on the kind of lesser spotted corners of the world of exploding helicopters. So yes, I have treated you. I think I'm spoiling you. I think right. Next time you come on, you're just going to have to do an absolute like bread and butter. Like, right. You know, somebody just fires a machine gun at a helicopter, right, and it explodes. I think I'm going to have to treat you to one. Well, treat you or kind of condemn you to one of those.
Right. Well, because I think, yeah, when you were on one of the times we did Ring of Fire 3, which is a more traditional, just like, you know, PM Entertainment, just getting the exploding helicopter out of the way, you know, early with Don the Dragon Wilson just firing a pistol at it and just like, OK, we got that part done. Now let's have some bikers driving motorcycles through a hospital and, you know, get back into the more PM stuff.
Right. Yeah, that was a wild opening to that particular film. But hey, going to put an exploding helicopter in the first 5 minutes of your movie, I'm you know, you're not going to hear me grumble about it. But
exactly.
Well, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Matt, thank you for coming on and talking about Bulletproof. Would you like to tell people where they can find you online and what you got going on at the moment?
Yeah, so dtvconnoisseur.blogspot.com, that's where you can kind of find everything, and kind of maybe calling back to the episode you did with Doug Tilley where he was joking about how he shouldn't have named his podcast Cinema Smorgasbord because nobody can spell it. I learned very early on in 07 when I created my site that nobody can spell connoisseur properly, and I don't blame them. I've seen, when I look at Google and they show like the different search results, connoisseur is spelled all manner of ways, and so yeah, I learned my lesson there. But you can go there to find everything social, the podcast, all that. The podcast is DTVC Podcast. Find that on all your major podcatchers. My novels, The Chad and Accounting, Girl and a Gun, and Holtman Arms, they're all available. Again, this one I didn't have any choice over. My last name is very difficult to spell as well. Poirier, Poirier. That's not easy to find me there. So, but if you look up Chad and Accounting, you should be able to find all my novels. I'm hoping in August to get my fourth novel out, Don's House in the Mountains.
Thanks for all that, Matt. And hopefully people can get a close enough spelling for your website or for your novels to actually find any of this stuff. When I'm trying to spell connoisseur, I just put two of everything in terms of the spelling, and that kind of gets me there.
But, exactly, that makes sense.
As always, don't forget to check out the Exploding Helicopter website at explodinghelicopter.com for more reviews and information about how helicopters explode in films. If you can help spread the word about what we do on social media, I'd be very grateful. We'll be back soon, but until then, what should people do, Matt?
Watch the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Bird season's over, Budhorn.